In first part of the talk, I'll tell you about some of our work on DNA electrophoresis, and it will go basically like this. I'll first describe the experiment, describe some predictions, show some results, and at this point I will break with tradition because actually they won't agree and I'll have to go back a few iterations. The reason why I'm doing this is because I want you to think about this. Yeah, this is relatively fundamental or basic stuff from electrophoresis, but it's been my experience that a lot of biophysicists, even though we use electrophoresis a lot, don't actually necessarily understand how it really works all that well. And so I think it's useful to go about it in this way. This is an older work. It was published in 2009. Shua was very convincing and threatening, and so I finally agreed to speak about it. But I will spend the last 10 minutes telling you about some more recent results, things that we're working on now at the moment, which is actually unpublished work. All right. So the experiments I'm going to tell you about are a combination of two experimental techniques, namely solid-state nanopores and optical tweezers. So the solid-state nanopores, in a nutshell, are just a very small hole. And the way we make this is we make a very thin suspended silicon nitride membrane, and then we're using a focused electron beam, we drill a very small hole. And by very small, I mean anything from a few nanometers to several tens of nanometers and up to, say, hundreds of nanometers. This is done in a transmission electron microscope, and the microscope is used both to drill the hole as well as to image it afterwards. So we know the size of the pore that we're going to use before, independently, say, of the measurement of the ionic current, etc. So I'm sure most of you are familiar with Coulter counters, so the idea is very simple. If we take now this membrane and use it to separate between two reservoirs, apply a voltage difference between the reservoirs, and we then drive an ionic current that we can measure as a function of time, and if macromolecules pass through the aperture, they interfere with the flow of ions, and they lead to a change in the measured current. So this would be a typical translocation event, where the current in this case goes down and goes back up once the molecule translocated to the other side. Now, this experiment, we combine the technique with optical tweezers. We've already had several very nice introductions, so I will not go further into it, but just in a nutshell, we can both manipulate a bead, move it around, as well as measure the force being exerted on the bead. And so in this experiment, what we'll do is start with a bead to which are bound, here I show only one, but it's on average four DNA molecules. We bring this bead close to the aperture of the nanopore while applying an electric field. This basically sucks in the DNA through the nanopore. Once this occurs, we can then withdraw the bead a little bit so that the other DNAs that are also present on the bead do not get sucked in. So this is what typical data looks like. Here's the current as a function of time during one of these capture events. So we start with a constant current, and then as we bring the bead close by at some point and we wait for a while, at some point the current drops due to the DNA actually entering into the pore. And what you see here is that the current does not go back up. This is because we now have a static situation where the electric field is pulling on the DNA through the pore and the bead is holding it back from the other side. So this is a static situation and we can maintain this configuration for a long time if we so desire. Now, simultaneously with this, we also record the position of the bead, that is to say the force being exerted on the bead, and simultaneously there's a drop, an increase in the force as the DNA goes through the nanopore and starts to pull on the bead. Interestingly, actually, there's a slight delay, so the drop in current is instantaneous as soon as any part of the DNA enters the pore, whereas the force is slightly delayed by a time that corresponds roughly to the time it takes for the DNA to first thread through the pore until it becomes more or less taut and then can apply the full force. These data look quite noisy. This is because of the time scale. We can average over a long time and get a good reading of the force and of the current. All right, and the question I want to address today is, okay, very nice, and what is the magnitude of the force, and can we understand it quantitatively? What gives rise to the force, and what is the magnitude of this force? Okay, so let's start with the simplest possible picture. I have my pore, I apply what I control as a total voltage difference across the two sides. This will give rise to a rather complicated electric field distribution. The field will be maximum in the pore. This is the point of highest resistance, but there will also be some field extending a little bit in the access region. But whatever this field is, the integral of this field has to correspond to the applied voltage. So now, if I have DNA, if I think purely in terms of electrostatic, the force will just be the line integral over the contour of the DNA, the local charge times the local electric field, integrated over the entire contour. Now the linear charge density of the DNA is a constant, so I can take this out of the integral, and I get that the force is just given by the linear charge density on the DNA times the voltage difference that I apply.
Okay,
so let's see what the experiment says. The experiment says that the measured force is linear in the applied voltage. These are measurements for three different molecules. You can also do it at different lengths, at different positions for a given molecule. You basically get always the same answer. And it's the wrong answer, because the force given by the lambda DNA times delta V is this red line here, which is also linear, but with the wrong slope. And so the force that we measure here is about 1/4 of the force that you would expect for the bare charge of the DNA. So at this point, a lot of smart people say, oh, factor of 4. I know where that comes from. And so we're not doing this in vacuum, of course. We have screening. So we have, in particular, both an absence of co-ions and an enrichment of counter-ions around the DNA. And of course, many people here are very familiar with the Manning result, that basically we expect ion condensation to take place until we've basically neutralized part of the charge of the DNA by locally condensing ions until we have a charge of 1 electron per Bjerrum length. And this happens, for the case of DNA, this happens to correspond to the linear charge density of DNA, 2 electrons per base pair, divided by 4.2, which is pretty close to our experimental result. So now if I say, okay, well, if I assume that these ions here are not mobile and not participating in any way to the current, then the force that I expect will just be given by this effective charge density times delta V, via the same argument as before, and I expect to get about 1/4 of the force. Okay, let's look at some more data. These are forces measured for the same lambda DNA in two different pores. And the main difference between these two pores is that this one is small, it has a radius of 4 nanometers. This one is 10 times bigger. It has a radius of 40 nanometers. And the force is also different by about a factor of 2. Now, if the force that we're measuring is a property of just of electrostatics of the DNA and its counterions, then we expect this force to be independent of the size of the pore. It should be a property of the DNA, not of the measuring system, not of the pore. We can repeat this experiment for different sizes, and this is, we see basically a relatively smooth trend. It's a relatively weak effect, but nonetheless, there's a clear trend that the force decreases as we make the pore bigger and bigger. So why is that? What's happening? Well, in fact, the answer is not a mystery. It's been in the literature for a long time, and it falls directly from the fundamentals of electrophoresis. But in the context of a cylindrical pore, it was worked out by these gentlemen some 15 years ago. In fact, what they were trying to discuss is what are the forces experienced by DNA as it goes through a gel. And because the geometry of a gel is too complicated, they said, well, we'll do as if the gel was basically just a cylinder through which the DNA is going. So basically what we've done in our experiment is to construct probably the most expensive gel ever per cubic nanometer and sort of realize this geometry. Okay, so the argument goes like this. Once again, we're not doing this in vacuum. So we have our DNA and we have a screening cloud of ions around it. Of course, the DNA experiences a force pointing, let's say, up, and the counter ions exert a force pointing down. Furthermore, the force on the counter ions is equal in the total force on all the counter ions has to be equal and opposite to that on the DNA, because that's what the counter ions do. They exactly cancel the charge of the DNA. So that means that I have two forces. One is pointing up, the other is pointing down, and they are equal and opposite. So then the next question, well, the next thing is that the force on these ions, of course, these ions are not moving in vacuum. They're moving through water. So they experience viscous drag in the water, and therefore they can transfer the momentum to the water. So now we have ions here that are pushing the water and they are inducing a flow in the water. And then the question is, well, what happens to the momentum? Yeah, I mean, here the force is very clear. I'm pushing this way. I'm holding back from the other side, so there's no problem. But these ions are pushing on the water, dragging the water along. Where did the force end up? Okay. The easiest way to see it is qualitatively is as follows. This is just a picture in radial geometry. I have the DNA here. It's charged. I have the wall of the pore here. On the right. For simplicity, for these cartoons, I assume that the pore is uncharged. I'll get back to that a little bit later. And so we have basically this picture where we have a force being applied to the fluid, let's say downwards, where the counter ions are located. And so this means that I'm shearing the fluid in this region where I'm applying a force. If I make the simplest approximation of no-slip boundary conditions, or assumption, I'm sorry, of no-slip boundary conditions, then I end up having a flow profile that looks like this. And of course, it has to relax back all the way back to the other end of the pore. So this means, once again, that because I have counter-ions, I'm inducing an electroosmotic flow in the pore. All right. Now, what happens to the force? Then there's basically two places where the momentum can go. It can be transferred to the DNA, or it can be transferred to the pore of the wall. So these counter-ions indirectly induce a counterforce on the DNA. And just to be clear, this is not a correction that I'm introducing to account for something. This is the intrinsic part of what it means to do electrophoresis. I have DNA's charge, it has counter-ions, and there's a force exerted on the counter-ions, and there's a back action on the DNA. You cannot get away from this if you do electrophoresis. All right. So now, what happens when I change the size of the pore? Well, in order to really find out, you need to really solve for this flow profile. But I think it's fairly intuitive that if I look at two pores of different sizes, the region where the force is being applied is the same. It's set by the Debye length, basically, in my fluid. So this is invariant, whereas the position of the wall, of course, shifts as I make the pore bigger and bigger. So if I'm dividing a fixed amount of force, which is being applied over here between these two sides, you can think basically just in terms of lever arms. You expect that as this wall moves further away, you expect that more of the force will be communicated here on this side. So now we can apply profound physics, Newton's laws. So we have the force on the DNA, which is pointing in this direction. We have a drag force, which is pointing in the other direction. If I think in terms of the DNA, there's only one force left, and that is the force, the mechanical force that I'm exerting with my optical tweezers, which has to, because nothing is moving, we have a static situation, these forces have to balance out. And so end up with a force which is not the bare force on the DNA, but which is reduced by the presence of this counterforce. Now, if this guy is further away, this arrow is bigger, and therefore the force that I need to exert is smaller. Okay. If there's a second thing you can notice if you look at these arrows, and that is what happens here at the wall. So I'm shearing the fluid here, so I'm exerting a force on the DNA. I'm also shearing the fluid over here, and that means that I'm also exerting a force on the wall. And the vectors are basically the same. If you do the one-line algebra, what you conclude eventually is that the force being communicated by the shear to the pore itself, so to my substrate, is equal and opposite to the force of the tweezers. And this often gets people a little bit upset, but if you think about it, so I have a transduction system where I'm holding the tweezers in one hand, I'm holding the pore in the other hand, I apply an electric field, but the field applies no net force, because the total system is neutral. And so the field only acts as a transduction mechanism between my optical tweezer and my substrate. All right, one can do this a little bit more quantitatively. What we did to try to put numbers to it is to solve for the charge distribution using the Poisson-Boltzmann equation, so as a function of the size of the pore. You can then take this charge distribution and use it to calculate Stokes' equation. You can use it to calculate what the flow should be, and from this you can calculate the shear stress and extract the force that you expect to see on the DNA. And when you go through this process, in fact, I should mention the calculation had been done also by Sandeep Gosal in this nice form in terms of zeta potentials or surface potentials at the DNA and at the wall. And the advantage here is that as long as there's no double layer overlap, these are just constants, and you can see directly that the force decays logarithmically with the size of the pore. And so if we just take our calculation using known parameters and put them into our little model, we get this dashed line here, which reproduces the experimental trend quite nicely, but is quantitatively overestimates the force that we actually observe. So in order to get down to this level, basically, there are various ways, and I'll get back to that in a second. But basically, if we just arbitrarily decide that DNA has half of the charge that it does, for example, by postulating that part of the counter-ions may actually be immobilized into grooves, for example, then we recover something that looks very much like our data. You can also play some other games. You can change the salt concentration. So, of course, if you have higher salt concentration, the bilayer will be more compact. So, similarly, same lever arm game as before. If I make it more compact, I expect it will couple more strongly to the DNA. And so, as you increase the salt concentration, you find that the measured force decreases, which is consistent, again, with the fact that the counterforce becomes stronger, and therefore I need to exert less force with my tweezer in order to resist it. All right. So, yes, please.
Will the DNA be assembled before or resting against the side?
The Oh, I'm sorry. The question is, will the DNA be at the center of the pore or will it be on the side due to image charges? Well, first of all, we're dealing with a dielectric pore, so the image charges, which has a lower dielectric constant than the water. So the image charges are repulsive, actually. The hydrodynamics also favor moving towards the center, otherwise you have a very high shear rate on one side and lower one on the other side. With the big pores, we can see directly from the location of the bead and from the fact that it's not displaced as we increase the force, we know that we're fairly well centered, but for the smaller pores, there's no way we can resolve. So then we have to rely on the arguments that I just gave. So I think the trend is very clear, and then there's the remaining issue of this factor of two. And I must say that I'm not particularly concerned myself about the factor of two because there are many, many things that could be happening. I've mentioned already a qualitative picture is to imagine that some of the ions are immobilized and don't contribute and therefore don't play a role in the hydrodynamics. But we have to keep in mind that this is a really, really simple model. So in particular, neither the pore nor the DNA are perfect cylinders. The real pore is not infinite in length, whereas here we just solved everything in radial symmetry. The Poisson-Boltzmann equation, as we had a nice discussion at lunch today, is not necessarily supposed to hold in this situation. The use of no-slip boundary conditions is questionable. And finally, there's also the fact that our pore also has some charge on its walls. And so it is negatively charged, and therefore it is a positive counter-ion atmosphere around it, which means that there's also an electroosmotic flow, which may account, which is of the right order of magnitude to account at least partly for this factor of two difference. And so it's quite difficult to really nail down where the factor of two comes from. And I don't think that our experiment at this stage to really nail it down further. All right. As a very quick aside, we can also work on more complex systems. So we've worked, for example, with recce-coated DNA. So this is a protein that polymerizes on the DNA, making it fatter and with a higher linear charge density. This is what it looks like. This is double-stranded DNA, and this is a region where the recce has been applied. So we can go through the same game with this system, and in this manner extract a force as a function of salt concentration or pore size. And just very quickly, just to show, in this case, in fact, we recover the numbers. We observe the same salt dependence as we do for the single double-stranded DNA, the bare DNA, but the numbers actually come out without any additional sort of accounting come out to exactly being the right force. So perhaps this is a hint of the answer to what is wrong with our factor of two. The main differences are that the recce-coated DNA is bigger as a higher linear charge density, but the surface charge density is actually significantly lower, which means that one might expect Poisson-Boltzmann to hold a little bit better, and therefore our calculation to be more realistic in this case of recce. But this is a hypothesis, to say the least. All right. So to summarize this part, I've shown you that we're able to directly measure the electrophoretic force on DNA. And I hope I've convinced you that electrophoresis cannot be thought of simply in terms of charges as if we were in vacuum, but that hydrodynamics are important. They're an intrinsic part of DNA. And if you want to do anything quantitative about charges in which an electric field is applied, you have to include hydrodynamics and the coupling to the environment. You cannot get away with not doing that. So we think that the main contributions of this work, in fact, is to sort of highlight what are concepts that were already in the literature. And for this reason, we've also written a very so-called tutorial review on this topic, which is aimed at sort of fourth-year undergraduate level that attempts to explain this step by step. And so for those who are interested in the topic, I refer you to this particular publication. All right. I would now like to switch gears and just to check, because we started a bit late, how much time do I have?
You have a few minutes
left. All right, so I have 10 minutes or so, right? Okay, thank you.
11,
excellent. So in recent years, I've been thinking more and more about trying to develop new experimental techniques, and in particular, developing new single molecule techniques. I personally feel that, and I think many of you will agree, that a lot of the newfound interest in biophysics in the last two decades has really come from the explosion in single molecule techniques. By now, these techniques have become relatively mature. There's still a lot of work to be done, but we have a beautiful set of techniques that have become quite accepted. They mostly rely on mechanical interaction or on basically fluorescence. And I think it's a fair question to ask, are there perhaps still more single molecule techniques left to be discovered that really use completely different transduction mechanisms. And we started to think in terms of purely electrical measurements, different from, for example, the Coulter counter. So the technique I'm going to tell you about is about electrochemistry. And just to set the stage, and I'll come back to that at the end, but we have two goals, basically. One is that we want to use these techniques as a transduction mechanism for sensor platforms, for massively parallel electrical measurements for technology, but also as a single molecule technique where we hope to open the door to study the dynamics of new classes of enzymes, which are difficult to access with existing techniques. So, I think many of you will not have seen electrochemistry for some time, so let's keep it very, very simple. I don't have enough time to show you much data, so I will keep it at its very simplest, but just to give you a flavor of what it is that we're doing. So basically, electrochemistry works as follows. I have molecules that can exist in solution in two different charge states. These charge states differ by one or two or a few electrons. And if these molecules impinge on a suitably biased electrode, then it's possible for electrons to go from the molecules to the electrode or vice versa. And I can measure the electrical current that results. This current is proportional to the rate of molecules impinging. And if I know this rate, then I can work back what is the concentration of my molecules in solution. So the problem with electrochemistry as a single molecule technique is that it's virtually impossible to detect a single electron at room temperature in warm, salty water. Now, I've just shown you in the first part of the talk single molecule measurements on DNA in nanopores. And just to make it clear, the reason why this works is that we don't measure the charge of the DNA. What we measure is the charge of a much larger number of ions that translocate or that are affected, let's say, by the presence of DNA during its translocation. The actual charge of the DNA is only a small fraction of this total charge corresponding to this event. So what we need is a way to turn electrochemistry from a single electron or a few electrons per molecule into something like this. And the approach we've taken is so-called redox cycling. This is the basic concept. We have two electrodes separated by a thin layer of water. And we can address these two electrodes separately. So we apply different voltages such that this electrode gives electrons to our molecules. This electrode pulls the electrons out of our molecules. So now if you imagine a molecule undergoing Brownian motion, sometimes it will bump into this electrode, pick up an electron, after which it's loaded, so to speak, and then later diffuse into this one, give up this electron, and go back and forth in this way. Now, in our actual devices, the aspect ratio of the length versus the height is about 1,000 to 1. And so if you imagine that the difference between these electrodes is less than a pixel, then if I have a molecule starting in the center, it will take a long time to get out. It will hit the electrodes multiple times. And this is how I get my charge amplification. Just to be clear, so in the experiments that I'm going to show you, there is no convection. We're not driving the liquid. We have an entrance and an exit, but they're both coupled to a single reservoir on the outside. I have no migration due to electric field. This is done under physiological conditions. So the double layer is very compact compared to the width of the electrode. And so the only mode of transport is diffusion by construction in these experiments to keep things simple. And so if you imagine how long does it take to diffuse, say, to shuttle an electron from this side and to come back, well, the diffusion time scales as the square of the distance. So as I scale down the distance between the electrodes, the current that I will obtain will increase quadratically. And so this is why we refer to these as nanofluidic electrochemical devices, because we will want to make this spacing to be of the order of tens of nanometers in order to get sufficient amplification. And then a very simple calculation tells you that the current per molecule is given by the charge of the electron, the diffusion constant divided by z squared. No, there is not. Because I'm working at a 100 millimolar salt, the bilength is 1 nanometer. The height here is, say, 30 to 50 nanometers. And so there's an electric field, but it's located very close to the electrodes. And so there's a small correction of a few percent if I want to be very precise.
That means there is a current.
There is a current. So in fact, these are ammeters, and they measure the current. And I will show you plots of the current.
Apart from this current, there is basic current because of the salt.
No. So this is where the electrochemistry comes in. If I have sodium chloride, sodium has no way to transfer charge to a metal electrode. If I stick a platinum wire in sodium chloride, there is very little current that will, because there's chloride that can react with platinum. That's the problem with electrochemistry. The system is constructed such that there can be no electrochemical reaction taking place from the inner salt, and I have a much lower concentration of electrochemically active species. All right? The idea actually comes from Alan Bard's lab. It's a classic paper in electrochemistry, where what they did was to use a sharp metal tip and shrouded in wax and approach it close to the surface. So what we're trying to do is to turn this sort of tour de force type experiment into a technique that we can apply generally and on a daily basis. And the way we do this is through microfabrication. So our devices actually sit on chips. So this is just a silicon chip on the surface of which are the devices, and these are just contact pads to make electrical contact. If you look at the device in optical microscope, this is what it looks like. This is a glass channel. This is the inlet and the outlet. This is the top electrode with the two wires connecting it. And the bottom electrode, of course, is below. But these are the wires that go to the bottom electrode. If I make a cut through the device, this is what it looks like. What you see here is the thin white line is the bottom electrode. This is the top electrode. The purple region is where the water will be in the actual measurement. And the distance in this picture is about 30 nanometers, to give you an idea of the scale that we're working at. All right. And so when I say these are nanofluidic devices, the dimensions here are several microns. So the nano part is really only the separation between the two electrodes. Okay. So again, we've been working on the system for several years. We've done a lot of different measurements, but I just want to give you a flavor. So I jumped directly to our latest results, in fact, which are our single molecule results. So these are traces that we took with redox molecules present in such a way that if you multiply the concentration times the volume, we have about half a molecule present in solution. But the electrodes are biased in such a way that there can be no redox cycling current. So what you see here, the red black traces are the current as a function of time in our device, and there is no electrochemistry taking place. So what you see here is basically the noise of our electronics. Okay, so then what happens when we energize the electrodes such that redox cycling can take place, so we can have electrochemical reactions? What we see is we still have a baseline, although you can see that the baseline is getting increasingly ragged. And in addition to that, we have some larger excursions that depart from the baseline. And importantly, you can see in the top trace and in the bottom trace that these excursions are very similar, and they're perfectly anti-symmetric with each other, which is what we expect, since if we have redox cycling taking place, every electron that comes out of the top electrode goes to the bottom electrode, or vice versa. And so the fact that the two signals are correlated is a proof that we're really looking at something happening in the system, and that this is not just some random fluctuation from our electronics. Important control, we can swap the role of the two electrodes. When we do that, the baseline remains roughly the same, but the direction of the excursions flips sign. And this also makes sense because instead of the electron, the role of source and sink of electrons have been exchanged. Now, we think that there are two, rough classes of events in here. First of all, the baseline is getting increasingly ragged, so it's clear that there's something happening. And once in a while, we get these relatively long events as well. So if I zoom in on these relatively long events, then I get traces like this, and I can string many, many more of them. If you put on your pink-colored glasses and you stare at them for a while, you convince yourself that there are plateaus in there that are fairly well identifiable. And that in this case, in fact, from the amplitude as well, correspond is of the right order of magnitude to correspond to single molecules. So what we think we're seeing here is basically to have zero molecule going to one molecule, going to two molecule, and back to zero, zero to one, et cetera, et cetera. Now, we don't want to rely entirely on our desire to see what we want to see. And so you can also do cross-correlation analysis. Because we have two signals, you can separate out the anti-correlated part of the signal, which should be the Faraday current, from the pure experimental noise. And when we do that, we get what we expect. The instrumental noise is constant, whereas the anti-correlated signal scales as a square root of n and has the right amplitude to correspond to the fact that at the lowest concentrations, we're really seeing single molecules. So this is a purely statistical test that tells us that those plateaus are indeed due to single molecules. Okay. However, so this is not single electrons again. So here I have, in this, say, if I look at this region here, I would have one molecule, which is very rapidly at a time scale that I cannot resolve here. The shuttling is microseconds. Yeah, and here my time constant is about 100 milliseconds. So I'm integrating over 100,000 events, let's say, in order to give. Yeah, of current. I'm keeping the voltage constant, and I'm measuring the rate at which electrons are shuttled, which is a current. Yeah. When we started this, we had this dream of seeing beautiful curves with beautiful histogram, where we take our data, maybe have to smooth it a little bit, and then we'd plot it, and we'd see nice histograms that we could fit with a series of Gaussians. And we went through this process, and to our great disappointment, although with even with the noise level that we have at the moment, we still predicted that we would be able to see a superposition of Gaussians. And if we look at the actual histograms of the data, this is not the case. So this had us worried for some time, and this is where, in fact, this is part of the reason why I wanted to present this here. This is still a work in progress, and I very much welcome feedback on this particular point. So what we did in the end is go back and do some simple simulations of just a random walker in our system. So this is just pure diffusion. In fact, it's a simplified one-dimensional model. We have an active volume, and we have a reservoir volume, and we just track particles as they diffuse around, and we just count the number of particles that are present inside our device. And when you do this, what you see, what you get, of course, is some random trace. And here we just have the number of molecules, so it's all very simple. We go from 0 to 1 to 2 molecules. The main point, though, is that what we were hoping for when we started was to see relatively long events. And we estimated, so okay, the typical event will have a length scale, a time scale, which will scale as something L squared over D. And this corresponds to about a second or a second and a half in our devices. So we said, okay, we're fine. We have the time resolution to see the events. However, if you look at the simulation, this is not at all what they look like. What you see in particular is that there are some long events, but most of the time the current is oscillating very rapidly in a telegraph-like way between two states. And this comes from the fact that diffusion is a space-filling, diffusive trajectories are space-filling. So my molecule that enters, diffuses from here to here, does not sort of happily come here, hop in, stay for a while, and go out. But if it goes from here to here, it will do so in zigzagging back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And each time it crosses the boundary back and forth, that's an event. And so what happens, I get a series of very closely clustered events. So typical events are not of length scale, of time scale L squared over D. They're actually very, very short.
You still don't have Faraday processes across the interface. The electrodes are blocking for electrochemical reaction?
Well, this is a simulation, so there are no electrodes, but the idea is that I have a constant current every time that... These are simulations, yes. I wish I could have data like this with infinite time resolution. It would be fantastic. Then we would have our histograms, no problem. Of course, this is an old problem. It's a time of first passage or the gambler's ruin problem, a classic problem in statistics. And the distribution of resonance times is known. And in fact, it diverges as t to the minus 3/2 for short times. Just to restore our intuition, if you only look at trajectories that go from the left to the right, so another trajectories that enter and leave immediately, then you get something that has, in fact, that has a center at L squared over 6d, which is what we expected in the first place. That's my outlook. Yes, this is something we have not tried yet. Experimentally, this is our next step. Yes, absolutely. The problem is that if I put in the numbers with our current time resolution, with our present electronics, then we throw away all of this diverging tail. And we believe that these short events convoluted together are what actually gives us sort of the ragged-looking baseline. In fact, if we take these simulations, and we convolve them with the response function that we measure from electronics, and we just add noise, we just take a noise trace, and we just add it to our data, we recover data that look indistinguishable from what we actually measure. And in fact, if we histogram then this simulated data, we recover curves that are not quite identical, but that reproduce basically all of the main features of the data. And there are no fitting parameters in here. This is just all known numbers, as well as experimentally determined quantities. So this convinces us that we don't, yeah, I'm done. We don't see beautiful histograms because we're not expected to see beautiful histograms. So this was conceptually a flaw of relying purely on Brownian motion to hope to see a nice single molecule data. And so this is where we are now. So what we're looking for now is a way to breed Brownian motion, and we'd prefer to do so without violating the second law, because I'm sure there'd be consequences for that. And so experimentally, it's already been mentioned, I think it's relatively obvious, if you can outrun diffusion by taking a long channel and just pushing the molecules through them fast enough that you get a fairly well-defined passage time, then we hope to be able to recover this. So this is an experiment that we're in the process of building up. But this has also brought up the question in terms of signal analysis. Is there a way to partly reverse, say, the convolution process with the time resolution. So given our histograms, is there a way to somehow infer the original distribution from this? And if anybody has any insight into this, I would very, very much appreciate. We're simultaneously forging ahead. Ultimately, we want to look to use this to do single molecule assays. And we've been working on the enzyme tyrosinase that turns phenols that are not redox active into quinones that can be cycled very nicely. So this is what I wanted to say. But before closing, I would like to make one piece of advertisement since I have a captive audience. We just founded a new group at the University of Twente. We have a shiny new clean room, shiny new labs, and we're looking for two also shiny, bright faculty members to add to the group. And so please, by all means, the search is not officially announced yet, but in the fall, this is upcoming. And if there are people here interested in living in the sunny Netherlands, then this is a beautiful opportunity. So I'd like to acknowledge my collaborators. On the Tweezer side, Ulrich Kaiser deserves the lion's share of the credit. He's the person who actually built, designed the instrument, built it, and helped with the measurements. Stijn van Dorp and Adam Hall took many of the data that I showed you, and my co-workers, Linke Dekker and Kees Dekker. And on the device side, Marcel Zevenbergen was a PhD student who carried the bulk of the work, and the single molecule work in particular, with a lot of help from Pradyumna Singh. So with this, thank you for your attention, and thank you to the organizers.
I didn't understand about this the bisecrete length is very short.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, in order to exchange electrons, you have to enter into this debye layer where electric field is strong.
Yeah.
So what is the role of this fact?
Now, so there is a small correction. It's called the Fromkin correction in electrochemistry. So what will happen is that, let's say, the redox species that we use are neutral in one charge state and positive in the other charge state. And so when they enter the double layer, they will be slightly slowed down. It turns out that this actually can be accounted in terms of a slight correction to the rate of electron transfer. And we have done, in fact, we've published several papers on the subject, because here we have very high rates of mass transport. We can measure these rates. And here, on purpose, we drive the reaction with a very strong potential so that we're beyond the regime where this rate is limiting. And so we know that the electron transfer itself is not a problem. I can tell you what is a problem, though, is that the molecules adsorb a little bit every time that they come by. And we lose current because of that. We expected the signal per molecule to be about a factor of 5 higher than what we actually measure. And we have independent evidence that this is really due to adsorption of our redox species. Unfortunate, but life.
I have a very simple question. Way in the back.
Thank you.
Given the surface tension of water, how do you load the channel, and how do you keep the surface tension from destroying the channel?
The loading, it turns out, is very much a voodoo. So when we started, we were using a polysilicon sacrificial layer. We would etch it with the plasma, and then we would fill the solution, and things would fill out nicely, until we started to reduce the distance between the electrodes. And then we got problems with wetting, and capillary forces were no longer sufficient to drive it. So now what we do is a wet etch. So we etch, we prepare the device, we store it with the sacrificial layer still in. When the time comes to measure, we etch the device and directly use it. So it fills as this layer of liquid is originally, sorry, I go a bit fast, maybe this is jargon. When we make the device, we don't actually make it with a channel in it. We make it with a very thin layer of chromium. And basically, to make a device, you make a sandwich, and at the very end, you dissolve away the cheese. And this is done with the liquid. And so there is no problem of wetting the device, because you create the channel as you wet it. In terms of robustness, the devices are robust enough. You can drop them, you can hit them with a hammer, not too hard, but a little bit, and they seem to survive. You can push on them with PDMS, and they seem to survive quite nicely. They're only a few microns in width, which makes them quite rigid.
So I think I'm the next one with the microphones. I had a little question about noise analysis. So you came onto that later, but right at the beginning, you said something that in this part of single molecule biophysics is often said, which is, you know, the signal's noisy, but we can integrate it out and make it look smooth. And of course, later you redeemed yourself by analyzing the noise, and because there's loads of information in noise. But right in the first experiment of the DNA nanopore, I thought that by looking at the noise on the signal just before the DNA entered the pore and during the pore, that there was a rather different size to the noise and possibly time constant as well, but which I think you'd expect because just before the DNA got to the pore, you'd compressed it a little bit, there would be a tighter potential. So I was wondering whether there was actually information in noise in that experiment that you could milk.
I believe the answer, no doubt the answer is yes. I think it's very complicated, and it's maybe a good question for Shura. So you're absolutely right. So the change in the current that you observe is fairly complicated function of the geometry, the position of the polymer. In fact, I showed it, it's often referred to as a blockade, but it doesn't even have to be a blockade. In some cases, the presence of DNA increases the current because you introduce more counterions than you throw out normal ions. So in order to really learn something, you would need a fairly detailed model of the entire geometry, including the translocating genome. And as far as I know, nobody has attempted that yet. But it's a very good point, absolutely.
There is a new technique to sequence DNA by ion torrent, which is to measure the pH very locally, which somehow sounds very similar to you. How does indeed your technique compare with that of ion torrent? I mean, could you use that your technique to actually maybe read the pH due to a release of a single phosphate?
pH would be very difficult, I think, because you would here you need an electrochemical reaction that takes place. You can do electrochemistry with protons, but it's not a very clean reaction. So you would probably want to do it with a mediator. I think it would be quite challenging. If I'm not mistaken, the technology you refer to uses an ion-sensitive field effect transistor to detect locally the pH, and then you have a small volume in which the pH is being changed. If you wanted to go the sequencing route here, you would probably want to instead to have a polymerase that releases redox active markers that you can fingerprint, for example. This would be the way that I would try to go, let's say, and may try to go.
So, I'm going to talk since I've got the microphone. This may be a giant pain in the neck, but could you make multiple electrodes in parallel along the same channel?
And oh, yes.
Would looking at the correlations between those allow you to pick out molecules that are actually diffusing along the whole length?
Yep. This is lithography. You can make things in whatever shape you like, and we have made devices with three electrodes one next to the other.
So does that help this transit time issue?
It would be a way to partially counter, because you could convince yourself that by tracking a molecule entering, it gets here, it goes back out. So it would partly alleviate the problem, but not take it away completely. What you could do, though, is with flow, is to verify that each molecule that you detect gets you one ping per detector, which proves that you can really track it. And we have made such devices. We have no data with them yet, but you're absolutely right.
Serge, there is a little bit of similarity between your device and a photodiode, where a photon comes in and creates a cascade of electrons. What's missing in comparison is an amplification factor. In a photodiode, the first event triggers multiple secondary events, which then gets amplified. Could you imagine that whenever you have when your first charge hits the plate, instead of just discharging it or changing its sign, could you have multiple charges being released? So then you would get a very crisp, nice pulse coming out, just like for a photodiode.
It would be nice.
Set that as just at the trigger below, you get an electrochemical reaction, which then would be triggered by the charge hitting it.
But remember that. It's a complex question. Let me give two very short answers, but we can discuss it further. At the moment, as it's conceived, say the molecule itself is the carrier of the electron, and its capacity is limited by its electronic structure. So it can carry 1, 2, 3 electrons, but that's it. You could imagine setting up a system in which the transfer of the one electron somehow shifts the potential of the electrode. But for this, you would need really sort of quantum dot size. So the electrode would have to be nanometric in size. And so that would sort of prime it so that it could donate its electron back. But you would not gain much, I think. So as I understand it, at least, as I understand your point, I don't see how we could do it in practice. But we can discuss further.
Yeah, I'd like to make a historical comment that in terms of the picture of electrophoresis with hydrodynamic flows of contrions and also polarization of the contrionic atmosphere and so on, it was initially developed by Lars Anzauger in 1920s and till 1960s. And I'm not sure what the later developments added a lot to that fairly comprehensive picture.
Yeah, the maybe just to be clear, if it didn't come out right. So as I said, the paper I cited is a case where the exact geometry that we use was worked out. It's built, of course, on earlier work. In fact, the paper itself is rather cryptic because they assume that everybody knows this, and they just go through in a few lines of calculation.